Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Here we are, the Lindsay Clancy trial. As of our recording here, we're still with a jury that has not come back with anything. Very likely going to be hung. We're going to kind of tackle the conversation from that direction. But again, anything is possible here. But reading the tea leaves, the Lindsay Clancy trial is asking the hardest question in criminal law. Can a mother who killed her three children be held responsible when her own brain was the weapon used against her? 6 weeks of testimony, more than 80 witnesses, psychiatric experts who looked at the same woman, and some came to opposite conclusions. And now, after days in deliberations, 12 people have sent notes to Judge Sullivan indicating they are deeply split, making a hung jury look increasingly inevitable. Joining us today, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, to talk about what a potential hung jury would mean for Lindsay Clancy, whether this case would get tried again, and what it tells us when the system built to deliver justice stands on the brink and delivering no answer at all. Along with me, as always, my co-host, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Eric, the jury has 80-plus witnesses, or they've heard from 80-plus witnesses, 300 exhibits, days in that room, and they've already sent notes saying they're struggling to reach a consensus. The judge has now read them the Tirid Rodriguez charge, which basically tells them no future jury is going to have better evidence than they do, and they still appear very deadlocked. I'm not honestly shocked by this. I think a lot of people have said this is going to be probably where it goes, considering the ether and the temperature in the room outside. It's a good gauge of what a jury room is going to look like. But they didn't have access to social media. They didn't have the conspiracies running wild, in their heads every day like we have. Are you surprised at all? What's your thoughts that we're sitting here with what looks like is going to be a hung jury?
Gosh, not a huge shocker to me, Tony, in part because of how polarizing this case has been. You know, when we talk with our family, we talk with our friends, colleagues about the case, there is a ton of middle ground. It's usually people are on the extremes of one side or the other. And so the jury is kind of a microcosm for society at large. And so that polarization may be going on back there. Folks have probably dug in their heels at this point in this stage of the deliberations. And I think it's reasonably unlikely that they're going to change their positions. However, I have seen it before.
You know, Eric, with that, you know, I'm just running my own thought experiments because, I mean, we're all right on this one. This has been the most polarizing case we've ever covered. And it's pretty profound about how, like you said, dug in people are on this. I can't imagine, especially with the coverage that's gone on, you know, the jury's supposed to sequester themselves and not pay attention. Hard to imagine they have, but in any event, so say it goes to retrial and they try to sit another jury. It's hard to imagine a scenario where it doesn't happen again. So in my mind, and this is what my question to you is, do you think they're going to press more for some sort of plea deal to avoid what they probably see as inevitable? And not just in this case, but is that generally what happens in cases where it gets this kind of severe notoriety, or maybe this is a landmark case for it just because it's risen to this level?
Robin, it's not uncommon at all for the attorneys, even during trial, even during deliberations, to be thinking about, hey, is there some sort of resolution that we might be able to come to? Because both sides have tremendous exposure. If Lindsey Clancy is convicted, she goes to prison probably for the rest of her life. If the prosecution loses, that's a tremendous black eye when you have three dead kids and you didn't do a great job. And so could both sides sort of come to the table and be like, hey, is there a way that we can sort of both get out of this relatively unscathed with some plea to a lesser whatever? Those discussions happen frequently during trial and even during deliberations.
Are you seeing any sort of leakage from either side of what you think either side would agree to? Again, I know it's pure conjecture. You're an armchair quarterback sitting back in this, but I'm just curious about, you know, what would either side see as a compromise win, do you think, from that point of view?
Gosh, it's a little hard to say. You know, the defense lodged what's called a lesser non-included charge that they required the court, or the court required the charge to be added of manslaughter. Perhaps, you know, that's less than first degree murder. It's less than second degree murder. It still carries significant prison time, but something that would give Lindsey Clancy a lot of life on the outside after this. And so that's a possibility.
Let's talk about those possibilities and logistically what that looks like if they come back deadlocked here, and just so we can have it on the record of understanding where their options are in this moment in time. Are there any roads, I should say, of which the jury can travel being deadlocked where this doesn't then get drug out through more hearings and a bench trial where both sides are able to come to the table relatively quickly and have some sort of settlement agreed to as to the outcome of this? Or does a deadlocked jury in this case mean, okay, we may get to some other resolution, but it means either a bench trial, new hearings that are going to further extend this months, possibly years down the road? Or is there something where in the container of this current trial and situation, even with a deadlocked jury, both sides with the judge are able to come to some sort of a resolution? Does that exist?
It could potentially exist. So the jury right now is deadlocked. If the judge determines that there's a hung jury, meaning they're not going to reach a unanimous decision, that's a mistrial. What that means is the prosecution can seek to set a new trial date and we could start all over again. Now, in the pendency of that new trial, during that interim, certainly if I'm defense, I'm going to the prosecutor and I'm saying, hey, look, you guys gave it your best shot. You guys had 80 witnesses. You had hundreds of exhibits. This lasted weeks and weeks and weeks. You gave it your best shot. You guys tried hard, but you couldn't convince a jury. There is no indication that you're going to get a different outcome if we do this again. So how about having her plead to something? And those discussions can take place while the district attorney is deciding how they might want to react next if there is a hung jury.
Yeah, do you see if they were to retry it, you know, as the prosecutors are thinking about retrying it, I mean, literally, what difference, what could they do differently? Because there are new testimony they could bring in. I can't imagine new experts because, again, part of the argument against the prosecution was the time removed from the interviews of Lindsey to the actual crime itself of killing her kids. And if they brought in more, that'd be even more time removed from there. So it's not like they're going to bring in new experts that have more depth of field necessarily, because again, experts seem to cancel each other out. The people standing with Lindsey saying that, yes, this is a break from who she was. And I don't see that shifting majorly in any way. So I guess what other new road could they go down? Would it be attacking the investigation, as we've seen so many of the wonderful people in the TikTok verse, you know, saying that they did a horrendous job of? I mean, literally, what more could they do than they've already done?
That's the thing, Robin, is basically speaking, the facts are the facts. Now, they could try to do some additional investigation. They could try to find additional ways to attack the credibility of defense experts and things like that. But by and large, the evidence isn't changing. The evidence is what it is. And so, you know, there's not going to be some kind of rabbit they can pull out of their hat during this second trial that I think would substantially change things. I just don't – I can't see that.
And one more question on that. And again, it's the legal side. I don't know nearly as well as you, obviously. So say the prosecutors want to retry it because those two seem like, you know, I want her no matter what. Can the judge decide whether it gets retried or not? I mean, like, who makes that final decision on how to move forward with this case?
That shows how much power a prosecutor can have. That the decision whether to seek a second trial after a hung jury is really solely within the discretion of the prosecutor. And if the prosecutor wanted to move forward, the judge would not have the legal authority to be like, eh, I don't think that's a good idea. Eh, I don't like this case. Eh, I don't think you're going to win. None of those things would be in effect. And the prosecutor would have the sole decision-making
power.
Is there
a limit about how many times it can retry a case?
I don't know that there is a specific number that the law talks about. However, there are legal grounds like a speedy trial. They have a speedy trial right. They have a due process right to not have a harassing prosecution. And maybe after the second one, they could argue, hey, this is just harassment at this point. This is vexatious. And so there are kind of ways to limit the number of retrials. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah. What sort of appetite does a prosecutor typically have after a case like this? We saw Karen Reed got retried, and we know how that went. Also a Massachusetts case. When you have essentially the same set of facts, you're going to have essentially the same pool of people that you're going to be picking in for. So your odds of having a few holdouts here or there and ending with the same sort of jury, extremely high. I mean, the appetite is got to be considered. But even beyond that, because obviously they can redo it if they so have the appetite. But the defendant herself, Lindsay Clancy, she could ask for a bench trial, could they not? And if you were Reddington, having gone through this once, knowing the state of your client, do you go down that road?
So a few things. My understanding is that under Massachusetts law, if there is a first-degree murder charge, that has to go to a jury.
You're right.
Now, if it's a lesser – for example, if the jury came back not guilty on first-degree murder but hung on manslaughter or something, my understanding is that a manslaughter charge could go to only a judge. Now, that's risky on the defense side because when you're talking about a jury, you got 12 people. You need to convince at least one of them to vote not guilty, and then you get at least a hung jury. If you convince all of them, you win. But when you have a judge, you only have one person, not 12, who you got to hope sides would side with you. And so the judge part is a little bit more risky just in terms of the numbers game and how juries come down in terms of hung juries. A judge is never going to be – is never going to have a hung jury because it's one person.
Would Judge Sullivan be the guy that did it, or would they reassign a new judge to it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure.
I got to stump on Eric on one. It's rare.
I think it'd be most appropriate to get a second judge because the first judge would be privy to all of the evidence from the first trial, but the decision isn't going to be made on the evidence of the first trial. It's going to be made on the evidence of the second trial, and there'd be a concern that the judge's mind might go back to the first trial. I think they'd need a new judge.
Yeah, that's why I was curious, just because Sullivan seemed to really his objections, I haven't looked up the stats on it. Man, I got to do that one. For the objections that were made, was he more like, how did he lean on his objections and what he sustained and didn't sustain in them? I was just curious.
Yeah.
It's a good thing we got the answer here, everybody. It's a fact. It's a scummy government MK Ultra mind control that made Prozac for this reason, and the mind control program, come on people, evil CIA government. Well, I'm glad all questions have been answered. We're good. We're good. We're good going forward.
Jesus. Yeah, the brain drain I've had in the last week has just been profound. You know, we were talking about this before the show, Eric, and that is, you know, when you do assessments of cases, and in my case, human beings, you know, it requires a massive amount of empathy, which isn't sympathy, it's empathy to understand the viewpoint from someone else from their shoes, which is very defense oriented as well, because you have to understand your client, you have to understand it's huge understanding, which means you typically, just by the nature of who you are, you listen to all these really, really stupid things to try to figure out where they're coming from. And so it just occupies massive brain space. I just got to shut this shit down. It's killing me.
It's, yeah, it is. I mean, it's been a mental workout on this case. One more in this lane before we talk about the crazed person who showed up with the camera. If you're a mother watching every day of this, looking for an answer, I mean, this means a lot to a lot of people. What are you supposed to take away if the jury walks out without a verdict here? I mean, there's so much that seems to be riding on the verdict here in terms of understanding of mental health of women in postpartum situations. I mean, is this really more so not necessarily an indictment of the medical system, but of our society and an understanding of this sort of world? If we're not able to come back with an answer either way.
Gosh, you know, one thing I could say for sure, in my opinion, is that you would see more of these types of defenses, especially with mothers who may have been going through a postpartum process and were alleged to commit a crime, especially if it's killing their children. You are going to see this type of defense much more regularly, and you're going to see experts popping up who support this kind of a defense. And so I think from a legalistic standpoint, we can sort of pin down what that effect might look like from a societal or moral standpoint. Gosh, that one is a big question. That is tough to tackle. I don't know. You know, if a mom kills their three kids, should they be able to get off with some sort of hospitalization? It's a hard question.
It's only in the state too, because most of the states aren't as the education on what the laws are when it comes to not guilty by reason of sanity or not criminally responsible, there's huge differences between states, massive. I mean, if this had happened in one of the four that don't even have this as a possibility of defense, then we wouldn't even be talking about this. And so that's what it's also pretty interesting about this and where this occurred, and it's just
I feel like it's a false comparison. I've seen so many damn. I just did a monologue about this morning. Is the another Lindsay Clancy? I keep saying that in headlines when there's basically a mother and dead children. The headline becomes it's another Lindsay Clancy, and I think that's so insanely disingenuous because it's not. This is such a unique case. Postpartum psychosis is statistically is a rare thing. I do wonder if it is more prevalent than we actually know statistically. But when we had, what was it? Andrea Yates. Comparisons going on here. People are like, well, Lindsay Clancy is going to make all these women run and claim this. We didn't see a giant uptick after Andrea Yates. No, it's not. That didn't change the landscape. Neither is this going to change the landscape. And when everyone keeps jumping onto this, this is going to start the precedent of more mothers doing this. No, it's not. I mean, everybody's saying it's another Lindsay Clancy, just as they did for the last 20 years, another Andrea Yates. And you look at the case details and it's like, no, these are really nothing alike.
And here's why it won't be and hasn't been before. And that's why this one's so unique. So we always say, a lot of people say anyway, that the experts cancel themselves out, even though they agree in a lot of areas with her mental health issues. Just their definitions of what the individual psychologists are saying was criminal responsible is their own context from the laws in their own states as well. So that's why it's a little bit of moving target. But they all agreed on a lot of things, not all of them on the postpartum psychotic spot of it, but all the mental health issues, yes. And so here's what's extremely unique in this case. It's remove the doctors and their opinions and their analysis and all that. The huge difference is her and her family, the support network around her that gives all the other data points for the jury to use in their deliberation. In other words, all these other cases where people are going to be a lot more Lindsay Clancy's. Really? Have you seen this many people on any other case that stood by the defendant that actually were part of the family that lost their kids and said, we stand by her. She's not, it just wasn't in her right mind. There's something wrong here. Coworkers, family, loved ones, ex-husbands, all of them are saying exactly the same thing. That's what makes this one extremely unique. Because do your own thought experiment. If you're one of these rare people, comes from a very, very healthy family, as my wife said to me the other day, if you had done this to our kids, there's no way in living hell I would have thought that was you. Something had to be going wrong in your life. Some psychotic break or something, because that is not you. So that's what makes this one unique.
Yeah, I agree. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsey Clancy trial. And Todd, I know you're watching in the background. If we have anything that breaks during this, let us know. I know the jury is still out as of right now, but if we need to jump into anything, we can. Ta-da! In game show fashion, the response.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The Lindsey Clancy trial continues to be one of the most heartbreaking and emotionally exhausting cases we've ever covered. Right now, we're watching a jury struggle in real time, deadlocked after days of deliberation. By the time you're watching this, we very likely will have an answer, and that answer may be a hung jury. Trying to untangle the devastating reality of postpartum psychosis versus premeditated murder. But as the stakes inside the courtroom, if they weren't high enough, the circus outside just breached the perimeter. A 56-year-old woman was arrested outside the Plymouth courthouse this week, accused of secretly filming the jurors as they left. She told reporters she just wanted to see Lindsey. But police found deleted videos of the jury on her phone. Eric Faddis is with us, defense attorney, former prosecutor, to help us discuss this along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. It's a madhouse. I don't know another way to put it. Every time we see the coverage outside of a trial these days, it reminds me of my days working in radio outside of a concert, where you'd have your tent outside and sometimes you'd have a promotion going, come by, win a t-shirt. It feels like that. And that's weird to me when you're talking about three dead kids and this atmosphere. But it is what it is. I mean, we can criticize it all day. People are very up in arms about this. They're passionate. Passion's not a bad thing, but when it gets misdirected, when it gets crazed, when it gets dangerous, when it gets expository of people who are just trying to do their jobs, like jurors showing up for their duty, being filmed, it gets a little scary. The immediate threat, the deadlock, Eric, this jury was already struggling towards a potential deadlock and feeling the immense weight of this case before this woman was arrested in the parking lot. The judge actually had to question them one by one about it before they could resume deliberations. Practically speaking, I mean, how does an outside disruption like that push an already fragile, exhausted jury towards, you know, a decision of some sort? And I mean, we'll get to the fallout of what that could possibly mean, depending on what that decision is. But how do you react to that as either a prosecutor or a defense attorney when something like this occurs?
Sure. So there are a number of issues at play. One is possible juror intimidation. Another is a juror's perception that someone might be intimidating them, even if that wasn't the original intent. You know, look, these jurors, it's such a high stakes case. You know, we have three dead children and they've got a horribly difficult decision to make. They didn't sign up for this. And they want to keep their identities anonymous because think about the backlash that could come from their decision. Either way, there's extremists on both sides who could lodge threats and God knows what. And so I think it's a significant intrusion into the integrity of the jury system. And I worry that these jurors might be concerned for their own safety. Who's going to out me? Who's going to post a video of me online? Yeah. And then if I let this lady off, is somebody going to come to my door and not be too happy about that? Those are some very real concerns. And I think they also give rise to a possible appellate ground if there is a
concern. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering about. I mean, the judge immediately asked them all, polled them all, basically, you know, said, did this woman's, did she affect you in any way, shape or form? I mean, basically a line of questioning was done and swore them all back in after the event. They all have answered that are back in the jury room. No, we're good. That's lovely and all, but does that make a damn bit of difference? Should, whatever verdict comes out here, I mean, let's play some scenarios. Let's play this scenario. They find her guilty. Let's say they find her guilty, and 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, a day later, whatever, sometime later, one of those jurors does an interview with somebody and something comes out of their mouth to the effect of, yeah, I voted for that because I was afraid for my safety. And for whatever reason that they've thought that decision would actually keep them as safe as they could. May not be what they fully believe, but they were pressured into it because of that action. Wasn't another juror, wasn't Becky Hill going to another precinct and weighing in. It was this event. And even though they told the judge, I'm okay, I really did feel this way. What does that do to a verdict, even though it's already rendered and they're sworn in?
I think that is likely an automatic reversal. The jurors cannot base their determination on any information or force or dynamic outside of what happened when the evidence was presented within that courtroom. And so if they felt some kind of pressure and that contributed even to a very slight degree in their final determination, and even if they said before under pressure when you're being basically interrogated by a judge in this very serious case, and they said, no, I'm fine, that doesn't necessarily alleviate the potential appellate concerns if there is a conviction and a juror did feel pressure. And that's a very real concern in this case. Those jurors in the back, think about how acrimonious it can be at like a work meeting when you have like 30 minutes and you're trying to come to a decision. These people have been doing it for days and days and days. And that pressure is very high as it is.
Do you think it was, I know logistically it's challenging, especially for 3 to 5 weeks of your life. Should they have been sequestered during this?
Sequestration, I think there's been a trend away from that. It's so burdensome for the jurors who, again, didn't sign up for this. They're just doing their civic duty. And to, put them in a hotel where they typically can't have much contact with family, friends, work, things like that. I think that is a bit overkill. And I think that the risks and costs of that process probably outweigh the benefits in my mind.
Yeah. What is the bar? Because you don't see it that often these days, sequestration, where they're in the hotel like that. If people don't understand what that means, it means you're not going home. You're not hanging out with your friends and your family. You're not watching. They're really, really making sure you're not getting access to this. And that's what's the bar that's keeping it is control. What is the bar, though, these days? What kind of cases? What does it take to qualify for a sequestered jury?
The judge has a ton of discretion there. So the judge is kind of the steward of the jury. The judge has to look out for the jury and also has to make sure they're not being improperly influenced. And so usually that threshold is just sort of the judge's subjective opinion in terms of, is there a risk that outside information and influence could creep in to this jury process during this trial? Is that risk high enough to justify the burdens of sequestration? And I think judges are trending away from that. And I really haven't, I can't recall the last time I've actually seen a judge decide, hey, yes, we need to sequester for this entire trial. And so that just goes to show how difficult it is to obtain that.
Unless you're in the reality show Jury Duty that's on, what was that?
That's true.
They sequestered him in that.
That was a good one.
Crazy.
I want to go back to the, what if scenario here. So we talked about if a juror comes back on somebody's podcast and says, I felt pressured and this is why I voted this way or that way. But more so, I mean, it would be more effectual if it was I voted guilty. What happens here, though, if no juror says anything at all? I mean, does Reddington have a card to play regardless because of this incident, if they have to go to appeal, if they were to be in that sort of a situation?
That's tougher. I think that would be much more difficult for the defense. And usually what often happens in a case like this, if there is a guilty verdict, defense will ask to interview each one of those jurors. Thing is, though, Tony, these jurors do not have to subject themselves to this to an interview with defense counsel or anyone. In fact, they're given an instruction at the end of the trial that basically says, hey, if you don't want to talk about this, man, you don't have to. And no one's going to force you unless there's like a hearing and you're subpoenaed. But So you really need something from the jury. You can't just say like, oh, there was the appearance of outside influence because that lady tried to film them. That probably isn't enough. You probably need some morsel, at least, from a juror saying, yeah, I noticed that. And yeah, I think it did have an effect.
What if, because again, going to what Reddington has in his tool bag in case it doesn't go the way he wants it to go, and you don't have a juror saying that, but since they had the mistrial request, you know, when they were invoking religion and religiosity and that, can he go back and use that as a threat? So even though it was sustained and the jury was given very strict instructions by Sullivan not to listen to those words, can he still then claim it had an impact since it was heard by the jury and use that as a grounds for appeal?
You can certainly argue, but at the appellate level, there is a presumption, a legal presumption, that the jurors will follow the instructions of the court. So if the court said, hey, I know you all heard this, can't unring that bell, but you can't consider it, there's a presumption that the jury will not consider it. So you have to, as defense counsel, try to unearth some kind of contrary evidence to that, that either they did consider it. And, you know, if they're talking on a podcast later and they're talking about how significant they thought that religiosity issue was, that those kinds of things might be enough.
So are jurors then, after cases, especially like this one, given really clear and good instructions by the court about what they should or shouldn't do, or what they're allowed to do or not allowed to do, and is it legally binding?
Do you mean before the deliberations or after the case is done?
Like after the case is done, like we're talking out all these hypotheticals on what jurors could or potentially say either to news, podcast, something like that, which could actually upend and flip things around or bring attention to things. In other words, just on this case, on this one with, you know, invoking, what was the statement? Not wrath of God or
mortal sin.
The mortal sin statement. You know, so are they instructed about how to conduct themselves after, and is it legally binding if they are?
In every trial I've done more than 60. The judge has a very limited instruction at the end of the jurors saying, thank you so much for your service. If you want to talk about this with somebody, you can. And if you don't, you don't have to. And if someone is pressuring you to do something you don't want to do, like talking about the case, bring it to the judge's attention. That's pretty much it. So that's pretty broad. That allows the jury kind of to, it's in their hands. They can do what they want. And some jurors want to talk about it. Others want to get it behind them.
And jurors, I mean, in a high profile case like this, the reality is going to be there is a potential payday there for any one of them. If they'd like it to be, I can guarantee if you want a book deal, you'll get a book deal. If you want there, I mean, it is what it is. And I don't know if there's anything necessarily wrong with that. I guess it probably depends on how one is using that, whether it's, you know, in a way of trying to, you know, spread a message of some sort of awareness for the greater good, or just to cash in on the death of three children. There's two kind of lanes there that could take. But the possibility is there. So we're inevitably going to hear from some of them. And I mean, it'll be fascinating. When we do hear from some of them, Eric, just pure conjecture, what do you think that conversation's going to be like? What do you think we're going to hear really from any of them when they're describing what was going on over these however many days, roughly 30 some hours in that jury room?
I can't even imagine. I could go back to an example of, like, let's say you at work are trying to decide on what you're going to have for lunch. And there's like three different positions and someone's like, no, I want pizza. And it's like, no, that's unhealthy. Let's get Japanese or whatever. You know, that sometimes it's hard to reach a consensus on something as simple and trivial as that. And that could take, you know, 10 minutes or something like that. The amount of time that these jurors have been going back and forth with each other in what I'm sure is an emotionally charged environment with deeply held beliefs that implicate ideas of motherhood, of mental health, of women's health. People have strong positions about those things. And I bet that many of them are vocal about just how zealously they believe one thing or the other. And so I bet it is, you know, That's not the right. I was going to say a different word, but it's definitely a difficult, difficult scenario back there. Tense, acrimonious at times, I imagine.
I can't even imagine the mental exhaustion they're under right now. So the biggest energy draw in our entire bodies, believe it or not, is the brain. And when you actually keep exercising your brain that hard for that long, for that sustained period of time, I can't imagine how emotionally and mentally exhausted these people are. I know people are putting in the comments too, and we've all said it. I wouldn't pay anything to be on this jury. You know, at the very end, so I'd love to be part of this, kind of see everything that's going on. No freaking way. I really, hats off to them on this one. This is a rough one to be part of because it's impacting them for the rest of their lives, as if we know it would have, but also just the emotional toll this has taken, no doubt. Do they offer, actually, I don't think so, but I'll just throw it out to you anyway, Eric. Do they offer counseling to jurors after things like this? I mean, they have seen some really horrendous things. They've been through a lot of trauma just going through deliberations on this, I'd imagine, much more so than if you're on a jury for a traffic stop. You know, if there is such one, obviously, probably not. But, you know, there's a lot they're going through, a lot they're exposed to. You know, you're getting only a sense of it by looking at people are breaking down in the courtroom, but this is a lot for a human being to go through, and this wasn't something they've even volunteered to go through. Anything offered to them as counseling or anything?
Nada, to my knowledge. That it's not sucks. Something the government would pay for. Is there a need for it? Is there a reason for it? Probably. But to my knowledge, thought. I've never heard a court.
we're kind of playing the like what if scenario game. Has everyone, just curious, completely kind of off topic, but has anyone ever raised a claim against a state for putting them through a trial that like scarred them emotionally and their like mental health medical bills? I mean, it seems like it could be a logical one for some of the shit that a juror has to endure.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've never heard of such a claim, and I think the government would have significant protection and immunity, yeah, in part because it's enshrined within the laws that the jurors have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it would be a very, very different scenario, but would it be akin to almost a law enforcement officer or someone in the armed services coming back and suing the police department or the army because while they were doing their sworn duty, they encountered things that were traumatizing? You don't really see that. That doesn't really exist. Is this kind of in that same vein because it is a duty as a citizen that we're asked to participate in? So that kind of washes the hands of whatever the government exposes you to. It's like, good luck.
You know, yes and no, Tony. Yeah. I one thing that comes to mind is the Vietnam War. So there was a lawful draft. So the law said these folks had to participate. Yeah. And then some of them over there were exposed to Agent Orange, were exposed to other noxious chemicals that could, in their position, have a lasting physical impact. So the emotional piece alone, I think it probably doesn't get to any sort of viable claim, yeah. But it wouldn't be unprecedented for someone who was engaging in lawful activity required by the government and who sustained an injury to then try to make a claim after that, as many Vietnam vets did, and in fact, many of them were not, in my mind, treated fairly after that in terms of what they're exposed mm-hmm. to.
So, yeah. So suing the Commonwealth, no, not in any realistic way. But counseling, yes, just for your factor of pleasure. Massachusetts built this in 2022. The trial court launched a first-in-the-nation program, free short-term professional counseling for jurors distressed by service. 3 one-hour sessions by phone or video with a dedicated counselor. If they need more, the counselor refers out. The judge can also offer it to people who sat in on the pool and got wrecked by voir dire. I can't even pronounce that anymore. After ugly homicide trial, several jurors from the same panel have used it. So Massachusetts does offer it.
Hey.
Remarkable.
The more you know. Ba-dum-bum-bum.
So after the witch trial, they cancel you for the witch trial.
Yeah, that's great. They give you some candy. It's bring your trick-or-treat bag and they fill it up
for you. That's interesting, though. Yeah, I'm glad we asked that question.
Yeah, the true crime tourist epidemic is we've talked about it a bit. I mean, it exists. It's going to be there. Have the courts Are they prepared? Do they need to be treating the outside security parameters and what goes on when the jury goes to their car with more security and safety than they have? Obviously, it's very different outside a courthouse than it was in 1996. And it still seems that a lot of the security measures in many cases are still about there. We've seen some that are really stacked up very well. But is that something, in your opinion, that could lead or could use a little catching up to today's culture and obsession with true crime, Eric?
Are you kidding me? Absolutely. I've seen some clips from outside of that courthouse where things appear to be basically pandemonium. And that is a real concern in terms of the effect it could have on the jury. It's a real concern for the safety of the proceedings. And then what they got to do is up the security measures, but also balance that with the folks' rights to a public trial, to free speech, to voice their opinion outside of the courthouse. And so you have a lot of competing interests that would be really hard to balance for like a courthouse security team, you know? And so kind of a Herculean effort with how much things have ramped up in this new era.
Yeah, that would it's scary to think about how one individual could very dramatically upend a trial. I mean, this one may have. I mean, look at what Becky Hill did with her things. This one woman outside of the courthouse just trying to take a picture. I mean, if people can do far worse than a camera. This case has such emotional vitriol connected to it. Were you surprised that a person got that close to a juror, was able to take pictures of the jurors getting to and from their cars? I mean, I know it's a courthouse. It's a public building. It's not like they have secret underground tunnels and a secret passageway to load people in and out of. But I don't know, more fencing. I mean, we're several weeks in here. We do know the effect this case has been having on the country. The fact that somebody even got that close, is that, I don't know. Were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised in part because I recently attended the trial in Colorado for the dentist Daniel Craig, who was convicted of causing the death of his wife. Yeah. And when you're sitting in the gallery, if you even bring out your phone, if you just bring it out of your pocket, security will ask you to leave. You cannot even be brandishing a phone within the vicinity of that trial. And so the fact that this person got close enough, was able to have her phone, it's operational, she's taken allegedly photos and videos, that seems like a bit of a breach to me. You know, I think there can be other measures taken, like, hey, this is a public trial, and if you want to watch it, cool, man, but you can't have your phone with you, like things like that. Those are reasonable restrictions that could be placed, but it appears had been.
I thought we saw that, though. Didn't we see, I mean, that was my question at the onset of this, you know, because I think I watched every single minute of this trial, and they did a lot of panning of the gallery. I'm pretty sure I saw people with their cell phones. Matter of fact, some people that come on our show. I mean, because I thought I saw like reporters, podcasters actually taking their notes and everything. I was really curious because I know when I've gone to court in my own county, you got to leave that crap in the car. And even Reddington, now granted, I know he's, you know, one of the attorneys, but he's got his cell phone up on the table there with him as well. Yeah. What, you know, I guess, what the hell? I mean, were they allowed, not allowed? I mean, because like, how do you control that if you're allowing one guy to have it or multiple people to have it to not actually do a pan around? I mean,
In my experience, it's almost like a tiered structure of allowances. So folks who have press credentials in the Daniel Craig trial, they were allowed to bring their laptops. They could have their phones with them. I don't believe they could take their phones out, though. Whereas me, I did not have press credentials at that time. So I could not have my phone out. I could not have a laptop. I had to have an old school pen and paper to be taking stuff down. The attorneys themselves, they're allowed to usually keep all of their tech, and there's just little concern that they're going to violate the rules. But it's kind of a tiered structure in that sense, yeah. In my experience.
It's almost there's too much of an honor system at play these days. And it feels like what used to work, people just, you know, don't chase down the jury and take their pictures, is the strong suggestion of it is no longer working. It's scary. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to discuss the Lindsey Clancy case.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No